going into the 14th chapter of Romans, dealing here with a lot of practical issues about one's conduct in the faith, and we are seeing an extremely important principle right at the outset that ought to be heeded but isn't very much, and that is the recognition of variables in terms of human needs and personalities and so forth. That we have variables in our needs and development and so forth, so that you can't just lay down a solid rule, because that's what they did in the Old Testament. It never worked. There are so many factors and variables. So we'll get into that here in the 14th of Romans. The one who is weak in the faith, receive, but not unto contentious dialogue or debates. King James' expression here, doubtful disputation, sort of leaves things up in the air. You don't know what they're talking about. What they're saying here is not unto contentious dialogue. Don't argue with your brother, sister, over these issues. Each one has to come to their own level of expression. Now we will go for a parallel to James chapter 1. He says in verse 5, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask from the God who gives to all liberally and does not upbraid. That is, he doesn't greet the request with a charge, you know, with any kind of criticism. And it shall be given to him. If any one of you lack wisdom, let him ask from God, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith, not in disputing, contention, debate. For he who debates is like a wave of the sea, driven with the wind and tossed. Let not that man, think that he shall receive something from the Lord. For he is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. This verse has invariably been called upon to prove that if we have any wavering or doubts in our minds, God will not answer our prayers. That is a total, gross misapplication of that text. I have said to you in the past, the Lord does not worry about our fluctuating feelings. That is not the basis upon which he answers our prayers. Human feelings are totally undependable. Human feelings are largely physiologically oriented, based upon impulses or stimuli from the outside environment. Both the stimuli are unreliable, and the brain pattern that receives the stimuli is unreliable. So you have a very questionable process going on within us. There is no way that you can really control your emotions without falsifying them. You may control your reactions. You can control the way you handle your emotions. But if you feel bad about something, you know, you're trying to argue with yourself that you don't feel bad about it. That's just self-deception. This is where people get confused. It's not a matter of controlling your feelings. It's a matter of controlling how you handle your feelings. It is essential that you understand the total physiological aspect of feelings for you to realize how undependable they are. Now that brings us to the matter of doubting and faith. And I've always said to you that it isn't the feelings you have about your faith, but the reality of faith in your spirit through Christ. It is Christ's faith in you and not your feelings about faith. Your feelings of confidence. If you've had a relative that has died from some malady, and now you've got another one that is sick with the same disease, and you're praying that God will heal him, you're not going to have much confidence. You're not going to feel confidence about. We don't know whether the Lord plans to heal us or not of different things. So naturally, we're not feeling strength to assume God is going to do it. The big problem most people have with faith is that they simply do not know what God's going to do. And we have plenty of evidence in the Scripture to know that God does not always do the things we want Him to do. And He didn't even heal in the Bible everyone that asked or that needed it. Jesus did not even bring along all of His own family. Now that's a very important point. So when you're praying for your family, it's right to pray for them, and it's certainly justified to believe that God has things that He can do to help, maybe by allowing certain experiences in their lives and so forth. So by all means, pray for them. But do not assume that if you really pray hard enough or with enough faith, your family's got to be all saved, and if they aren't, it's because you lack faith or God isn't helping you. It'd be a total misapplication of things. There were those that Paul never got through to. All we can do is identify ourselves with God's process in the world. If God was going to force everybody to believe, He would have puppets on a string, right? Adam chose contrary to God. If Adam chose contrary to God, why should we assume that everybody in our family has got to choose for God? But we can pray for them, and the chances are very strong, very strong. God has lots of things He can do. But in the ultimate, we can't assume anything. Therefore, our feelings cannot go along with our commitments. It rankles me when people say, oh, I just know God is going to do this. How do they know God is going to do this? They're shooting in the dark. The tragedy is that such people, oh, I'm sure their intentions are honorable, but the tragedy is they're so devastated when it doesn't happen. I can give you numbers of experiences, but one I'm thinking of right now, a particular church situation where a woman, she was praying on prayer meeting nights and so forth for a person that was ill, husband, father, whatever it was. And she was just saying, oh, I just know God's going to heal, and, you know, and they're going on this. Well, then the person died. Well, what are we going to do with that? They hurt themselves, and they hurt the people around them. God never guaranteed the eternal, physical, mortal life to anybody. Not to anybody. If He was going to guarantee that no Christian should die, there are an awful lot of martyrs He could have stopped the acts from, you know. Why didn't He stop Paul's death, though? Why didn't He stop Peter's death? Why didn't He stop the martyrs through history? And why isn't illness potentially in the same frame of reference for a Christian, that it is a process God has allowed, perhaps even a martyr-like process? The Christian who dies as a result of the satanic processes of the world they're living in is perhaps as much a martyr as the person who was put to the torch in Nero's Rome. Why not? And what a beautiful thing for a Christian to be able just to trust Christ, dead or alive, whatever, just to trust Christ that He has things in His hands. As I read the lives of the prophets and the apostles of the Scripture, that was their lot. You see, the prophet, the more visible the prophet is, the less authoritative the message. The more visible the prophet, the less the message. The Lord had to reduce His apostles and prophets to ashes. Just like John the Baptist said, I have to decrease and He has to increase. For wherever the prophet rises with too much conspicuousness, the message is diminished. Isaiah had to turn to ashes before the message of his book came through with power. Now today, in the media and in many other ways, the prophet is put forward. I'm talking now about the messenger. He is so visible. I don't mean just by the picture, too. I'm talking about the forwardness. The man and his family and his organization, everything is so much the organization and the man and his family and all the rest, it's all brought forward. The very opposite of what happened with the apostles and prophets. Paul said, we're slated for death. We're marked for death. Every prophet of God is, in a sense, marked by Satan for death because he has to do that. Satan can't leave them alive. Satan will make the effort. Just like if you're out on the battlefield, you've got the enemy in front of you. You're not going to say, oh, he's a nice fellow, just a little misguided. I'll pass some tracts out to him. On the battlefield, you put a bullet in him. I don't know that that's right, but it's what happens. Satan's that kind of an enemy. Now, he's not going to say, oh, that guy's just a little misguided. We'll try to straighten him out. He's going to try to knock him out of the ring. Now, it's only the grace of God that counteracts that. And as long as the Lord wants his servant alive, he'll be alive. When he's through with him, he'll be dead. That's it. It's just that simple. That's a tough road. But to me, it's poppycock to start talking about, oh, we just, it's the Lord's will to heal everybody and keep everybody alive. You know, we'd overpopulate the earth if he did anyway. You know, people talk as though the only thing that keeps everybody from rising from the dead is our lack of faith. And everybody in the church that dies, if you really had faith, you pray for them to be alive. You'd be splitting the seams of this city very shortly if all the Christians always kept alive. Well, you know, it's nonsense. You have to go sometime. Of course, you have to also think of the individual. They're going to just sit and rot out at the age of 90 or 100 or 10, 110 or something. Oh, no, it's just silly to talk like that. I'm trying to show you that James 1, 3, or 5, I think, which is always used to charge people with the problem of doubting, is kin to this verse. It has nothing to do with doubts that you may feel in your prayers in general. Not talking about doubting at all. He's talking about disputing. So it's the same word exactly. Paul says here, receive the weak, but not in disputing, debate. Over here he says, if anyone lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally and upbraids not, but let him ask in faith, not debating, not dispute. What he's saying here is, if you want wisdom from God, ask for it. But if you ask for it so you can debate and dispute and so forth, you're not going to get it. Now, that was crucial in those days. Today it doesn't mean a whole lot, perhaps, but in those days, the debates and disputes on philosophy and so forth just raged throughout that part of the world. The Greek philosophers were prominent, debating and disputing in the marketplaces. Paul ran into it all the time. Before the coming of Christ and before the universal spread of the gospel, there was a lot more uncertainty and debate in the religious or the philosophical matters. Plato was not aware of the teachings of Christ. He came 400 years before Christ, or 300. Socrates and Aristotle, all these men came before Christ. And the world, the Greek world, was just alive with debating and disputing. Now came the gospel, came the truth of Christ, and Paul took the message, but running into the Greeks, he ran into the philosophers. But the Christians had picked up the same thing, and they were debating and disputing. Paul tells Timothy, don't go out and dispute and debate. You have a word to present. Present it. Don't get into it. Arguments and debates, I say to you, don't go out and argue with people about the faith, about Christ. Because you can so often win an argument, even if you win the argument, you lose the person. You see, the essence of any argument, there's only one central issue in any argument. That is saving self-respect. If it weren't for that, people would just discuss things. And one would say, well, this is my view. And the other would say, well, this is my view. And they'd have a nice discussion. But you have to save your self-respect. You have to prove you're right. Or you have to prove that you're not a fool. And you go and talk to somebody and say, oh, well, you're just such a fool to believe that. And you see, you have to come back and prove you're not a fool, right? Whereas you would just say, well, here's an idea that I have. I'd like to share it with you. And the other person says, well, that's interesting. Here's my idea. Don't ever debate with people about Christ or about your position, about prophecy or about predestination or anything else. And Paul says that later on. Hast thou faith? Have it to thyself before God. In the same chapter, see, where he starts out by saying, don't debate, don't argue. That's just all that does is bring dissension. And the people that don't understand, the more they don't understand, the more vociferous they are in their debate. There was a situation recently where there are two professionals that are presenting a position. And here is one totally ignorant, totally unprofessional in this matter. And he raised such a fuss as to nearly split up the meeting over his assumption that he was right and the professionals were wrong. That's so common. Isn't that common everywhere? The more you know about a subject, the less you're willing to fight for it. The less possibility you have of debating with a person who doesn't know anything about it. So it isn't that people are not entitled to their point of view, but it's that if they really are wise in their point of view, they'll just keep it to themselves and not to push it. You can share it with people, sure. Of course, one of the things that evokes debate is insecurity. The more insecure you are about your position, the more you're going to try to justify it and prove it to yourself. What most arguments are all about anyway, people trying to prove to themselves what they're saying is right. It doesn't matter who's right or wrong. It's really not so much who's right or wrong, but whose spirit is proper. Now, didn't Paul say something like that? It's necessary that there be divisions among you that the approved may be made manifest. You know what he meant by that? Not that the right person might be shown to be right, but that the attitude was shown up by the way they went at their discussion. Now, you find that out in a church fight, a lot of them. There are people lined up on two sides of the fence. It isn't a matter of who's right or wrong. Maybe they both have some elements of right and wrong. It isn't who's right or wrong. It's the spirit with which the person comes to the matter. Does one come in the spirit of Christ or in the spirit of debate, argumentation? James is saying there, if you want wisdom, you can have it. But don't ask for it if you're just going to use it as a tool to debate with, because you won't get it. That's all. Now, to say that means if you have any feelings of doubt, you're not going to get anything from God. It's ridiculous. It has nothing to do with all these other things anyway. It has only to do with wisdom. What he's saying here is that people who come together in the Lord, the first thing you understand is that there are the weak and there are the strong. Every assembly has its share of both. Everywhere in the New Testament, the emphasis is on the capacity of Christ to handle the weak. He says in the first place, like in the Gospels, he said, they that are whole need not a physician, but they that are sick. And the implication there was, and see, the Pharisees came to him with the thought that they didn't need anything, that they knew all the answers. They chided Christ because they felt that he was an imposter and so forth and so forth. So Jesus simply said, well, you know, if you know this and you don't need any help, fine. You know, you don't have to come to me. So the only people that are really going to get help are the people that feel they need help, and they'll come. It's amazing in the field of religion how many people have such absolute answers. One of the great travesties of Christendom. If I didn't know better, I wouldn't touch this sack of cats with a 10-foot pole of religion. It's so absolutely idiotic for one group to say we have the revelation from God and we are right and you're wrong, and the next group to say the same thing, we have the revelation, you're wrong. And the third group says, we have the revelation and you're wrong. Now that is just so idiotic, I can't even believe it. Whereas it's obvious that there are limits to anyone's capacity to have absolute knowledge. Just like Paul says here that we don't debate over these things, but we don't take a position of knowing all the answers. Now, Paul makes that very clear. In 1 Corinthians 13, he says, when I was a child, I spake as a child, I thought as a child, I understood as a child. When I became a man, I put away childish things. If it weren't for the next verse, we might assume Paul was talking about spiritual growth and saying, well, I've been growing up spiritually and I put away my previous things. But the next verse changes all of that. In the next verse, he says, now I know in part, then shall I know as also I am known. Now we see through the glass darkly, then face to face. Now I am a child, then I will know as I'm known. Then I will put away the childish imageries of the earth, and I will know the truth. All of us are children. One of the most important things you learn as compared to the truth of God, our knowledge is so basic and so earthly that we're like little children playing in a sandbox. That's why it's silly for one child to call another child a name. We all see darkly. We see things from different perspectives. We may both be saying the same thing or seeing the same thing, but seeing it from different angles. If I'm walking in a particular section of the city and I see the windows of a department store, see certain things in that window. So I see a friend of mine that evening and say, by the way, did you see the display in the window of such and such a store? No, I didn't see that. Well, were you downtown? Yes. In fact, I went by that store, but I didn't see that. And there might be an argument. Well, the truth comes out that one was walking on one street and the other's walking on the other street. Saw different things. Saw the same store, but different things. Now, of course, that's an obvious thing. It can be applied in many different directions. Perhaps it's essential for God to reveal to us, to let us see things in terms of our own particular need or personality. Some young men, for example, that very much need to take their focus off of acquiring wealth. A young man gets married. He's got his mind set on making $1 million, and he's really pushing that. So I say to him, a man's life consists not in the abundance of the things which he possesses. Don't push those things. Just having food and raiment, be content, and so forth. Some have to hear Paul's injunction. Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands. I've said in groups of young men, I've tried to press them in the idea not to put their weight on the earthly things and so forth, and to be content with the way their life is going. Hand goes up. Oh, yeah, I really believe that. So I haven't been working lately because I've been... I said, wait a minute, hold the phone. That's not what I mean. Paul said, let him labor working with his hands that he may have to give to him that needeth. I've pointed out to young men who are inclined to say, well, I'll only earn enough to keep body and soul together, and I'll spend the rest of the time, you know, in spiritual pursuits. And I have to remind them, if you only make enough for yourself, you're not going to have enough to give to anybody. It's nice to say, I don't need much. I'll just live out in the woods here, and then I can give all my time to relaxation. Oh, you need to earn something for others. I remember a young man, I picked him up on a highway. I don't often do that, but I did this time. And he had been hitchhiking out from the east. We got into a little conversation. He was on his way up to hippie heaven in San Francisco. I asked him, you know, how he got that way. And he'd been getting rides across the country and so forth. Well, I wanted to give him a little money because he was out on, he was had nothing and he was out there alone. And I said, look, I'm going to give you a little money and I want you to take this money and use it in some respect. It wasn't a lot, but I said, get yourself a place to sleep tonight, a little something to eat or get a haircut or whatever. But I said, let it be sort of a start for you. I'll stop and find a job somewhere and do a little work before you go on further. The conversation moved in a direction. I said, now, I want you to understand something. I can give you this money because I work. I earn it. And in a sense, I said, I'm taking money that I might otherwise give to my own family for things. I'm giving it to you because I work. And I said, you've come clear across the country taking from people who earn their money. And that's why you can get this far. I said, what I would expect of you is that you take this now and go out and get something going so that you can help somebody else. But I said, you understand it. That's why I can give it to you because I work. Now, you see, there's some young men that need not to be told that a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of things that he possesses, but he needs to be told, let him labor working with his hands that he may have to give to him that need it. You see why it is necessary for people who have a different shade of message. Some people need to have security. They need to know that in Christ they have strength and peace and they have the assurance that Christ is capable of sustaining them and handling their needs and so forth. But there are some people, on the other hand, who need to have a warning, who go out with bravado and brazenly not caring what Christ thinks or anything, and they just go their own way. Maybe they need to have the other side of the coin. Be careful. And this is a matter of predestination, they call it, although I don't like to use these terms because a lot of them are not really biblically oriented, they're theologically oriented. But the general idea is a debate that rages between the idea of people who are once saved, always saved, and people who are so-called falling from grace or whatever, eternal security and so on and so on. My position in the matter is this, specifically. If the only way we can ever be saved is for Christ to come into our lives, to invite him in, and not just to do good works. The only way we could be lost, if that were possible, would be to dismiss him from our lives. And it wouldn't be a matter of just not doing good things, see? Now, I've often said, I don't know anyone who really is able to do that. I don't know. Once Christ is in the life, people don't just dismiss him that easily. People, you may say that, you know, people get in a fit, and, you know, and they say, Lord, I don't want any more to do with you. But generally, it's pretty hard to dismiss him. Yet, you see, here's a point I've made. I can't guarantee to anyone that there's no way that they could walk away from God. See, I don't know that much about life in the world or God. Anybody who still cares about Christ can be assured that he's still there or they wouldn't care. See, all that's toward eternal security. But in the last analysis, I'm not God and I can't tell God what to do. So I just leave that little corner there. Somebody were to come up to me afterwards and say, well, you're wrong. I know so-and-so who dismissed Christ. All right, okay. Okay, fine. I had a young man that left the institute and the ministry over that point because I was not strong enough in my declaration of eternal security. He said he couldn't stand to listen to me any longer because I wasn't being strong enough on that point. This fellow had been studying theology for 2 or 3 years, and he now knew beyond any shadow of doubt that he had the answer. You see, that's the total travesty of that kind of thinking. I am sensitive to the people. I have to know that there are some people who need the assurance to know Christ is with them. There are some people who are being very careless that need to know that, you know, you can't just be totally indifferent to these matters. Because I see people starting out on a wrong course. I'll see someone, for example, get totally absorbed in a line of things that is causing them not to be able to come to any meetings. They're not getting the nourishment. And, of course, I've often always said to you, I'm not talking about just my meetings, I'm talking about any meetings. There are people who get so tied up with a course they're taking that they neglect the fellowship and the nourishment and so forth. Now, I think they're in a precarious position. They're on a down slide. I can't tell them absolutely and unequivocally that slide would not end in disaster. I can't tell them that because I don't know that much about the world or life or God. I can warn them. But you see, that's what they need, the warning. They don't need the other side of the coin. Now, Christ tends to suit to the needs of each individual the word that is received. Now, for this reason, I am not keen about setting forth an outline and sticking with it. I am accused of every kind of misapplication of homiletics imaginable. A seminarian coming to one of my meetings would be appalled at how disorganized and unlettered my approach is. But you see, there's a factor here. We're dealing with a large number of people. I don't know how many are here. I never count them, but you got a couple of dozen, maybe, or a dozen. You've got people here. Every one of you represents a different need. Now, how can I establish a line of things and just go chugging down that line, irrespective of your various needs? Anything that has to do with the human person has its relevance to the thing we're talking about because I don't stay in the stratosphere. I could come to you every night and talk about love and goodness and joy and peace and all that stuff. You wouldn't get any help. I have to get down where you live, and that takes me way out. And I talk about economics and politics and nutrition and psychology and brains and muscles and everything, because everything has to do with the subject. So you see, in my training, I trained for these things. There are 9 areas of the social sciences: history, philosophy, psychology, behavioral science, anthropology, economics, geography, history, I think. Those general areas. We took a lot of training in all of them because they all have to do with the person, with man, mankind. And they all help us to tie things together so that we can say, here is how the Bible applies to our lives. For example, people that are very concerned about the matter of faith and God isn't supplying their needs and so forth. Maybe they need some help in economics. Maybe they need to know that you can't forge Christ's name to a check in order to cover your bank account. A lot of forgeries in Christendom. People believe and are taught that all they have to do is say, in the name of Christ, and they're supposed to get what they want. To me, that's a forgery. You're not always sure that that's you and Christ, that Christ wants to authorize that check. You like healing. People think, oh, if I just say in the name of Christ, that means that he's got to heal me, he's got to hear me. Because doesn't he say in John 14, if you shall ask anything in my name, I will do it. And I can hear him spelling it out, A-N-Y-T-H-I-N-G, anything in my name. But they don't understand what in my name means. In my name means you have received a word from the authority who says, go and buy this in my name. Go and do this in my name. It's like the ambassador or the foreign service. The foreign representative cables the White House. What shall we do? Here's a situation. White House cables back. Here's what to do. Now you see that ambassador goes out not in his own decision or choice, but in the name of the United States. He is acting in behalf of and for the United States, not for himself. Now, if Christ says, if you ask something in my name, what he's saying is that you have the authorization from me to ask for this. And so you'll receive this. Now you say, how do we get authorization? Good question. You get authorization by presenting it to Christ, and if you feel at peace about the matter, you have authorization. If you have a deep sense that it's all right, everything's all right, that's an authorization. If you're uncertain about it, you haven't got authorization yet. That's where this matter of feeling comes in. You pray and you're not sure what God wants to do. But I don't sign his name to the check. I don't know that you can always feel in harmony with Christ. I don't know that you can always get the sense of what he wants. But the only way you can say to him, I am definitely praying in your name, is that you have had somehow that conviction. I've had times like that when I've prayed for people that were sick or with very serious things. And I've had a great conviction within that that's what the Lord wanted to do. And I prayed in that respect and in peace and so forth. And it's happened. People have been healed. Remarkable things have taken place. But that doesn't always happen. And I don't always have that conviction. And many times I pray, I'm not sure. So if I'm not sure, I don't sign his name to the check. Now, does that mean you can't pray unless you're sure? No, it doesn't mean that at all. All it means is you pray and you take what comes. You don't demand something from Christ. You pray for it and you're not sure what's going to happen or not. Fine, just don't demand it. So you just don't go around telling everybody you're sure it's going to happen. If you have committed a matter to Christ, whatever it is the answer. What you think about it doesn't matter. You're in his hands. For whatever reasons, this is the way it is. Maybe it's for your lesson, for your learning. Maybe it's for somebody else's learning. Maybe it's for any number of reasons. It doesn't mean that what happens is good. It doesn't mean that it's turning out right or all right. It just means that whatever is for the present time what the Lord has responded. Now with all of this, we'll conclude with this point. I should have concluded a few minutes ago. Receive one another, but not with debates. Every individual has his own little situation to live in and handle. Everyone has to handle it within the frame of their own situation. And we have no right to accuse or condemn or judge anyone as to the way their situation is going. I have no right to put on people burdens they cannot handle. I have to think of that in concern with our work, our operation down there. We have quite a few people involved. I have to think in terms of the good of the whole. And if something is occurring that is putting too much pressure on one member of the group, I can't just go to that one and say, now you have to bear this for Christ's sake. I don't know what they have to bear. I have to say to them, maybe we better do it differently because that's more than you can handle. Maybe I haven't gotten what the Lord wants here because I shouldn't put on you a burden you can't handle. If I am doing what the Lord wants in this matter, you'll be able to handle it. We all have different levels of tolerance and so forth. So we have to be at peace with one another and not look at somebody and say, why didn't they do it that way or why didn't they do it this way or they should have been more spiritual and then like this person. I can't tell people who we ought to like or not like. Some people are astounded if you don't like them, you know. I'm not astounded. I say, I can't imagine why you would. Somebody says, I don't like you. I'm not astounded. We have to understand this very deep principle. Receive one another. One of the members of the group down there received a vicious letter from someone because I made a decision that thwarted their plans, and so they wrote to someone that they thought was behind it and wrote just a vicious letter saying, you know, you're not a Christian and you're not this and you hide behind the Lord and all that kind of stuff. Just a terrible letter. And yet that same person, you see, I would look at them and say, well, they have some problems, but they, you know, they belong to Christ. We have no right to put people down because they're not doing things the way we think they ought to do it. Christ has something in each of our lives to do, and he has his own way of doing it, his own time frame. And what is important for one person at a given moment may not be so important for another. The Lord has to bring people along at their own pace. There may be some things people are doing that we look at and we say, oh my, how can they do that and be a Christian? When if we'd seen what they were doing before, we'd think they were really angelic now. The bottom line is, receive one another, not with contentious dialogue or debate.